purposes of higher chip galaxies. So we've heard about imaging surveys, infraspectroscopy, submillimeter, radio, all these different techniques. Now I'm going to be talking about another different technique that is a complementary way of probing higher edge of galaxies, and that is using closed absorption lines. Now this is a technique that has made great advances in the last decade or so, but most prominently in the area of profiling the chemical history of galaxies. Because using this technique at high redshift, all of the familiar UV metal lines are now shifted into the optical, and so you can measure abundances for a dozen or more different chemical elements in galaxies and the intergalactic medium. The downside of this technique is that you have one line of sight for every galaxy. So you can measure the chemical abundances to your heart's content, but it's very difficult to access the more fundamental properties of these galaxies, like their luminosities, their morphologies, and their sizes. So what we've been trying to do, and what I'm going to be talking about this morning, is using gravitational lensing to try to probe the structure and the sizes and the kinematic profiles of these absorption line systems by using multiply imaged quasars. So this idea isn't new, although we've put a slightly different spin on it. So this cartoon shows the basic idea. You have a single high redshift quasar, intervening galaxy that is strongly lensing that quasar, so you get multiple images. Now, usually you get the laws of lensing tell you that you'll get an odd number of images, but one of those is infinitely demagnified. So what you usually see is an even number, either two or four images of the quasar. We've been studying this one and only, as it sounds at the moment, this triply lensed quasar that's at redshift of almost four. This is a NICMOS image. And so here you've got these two very bright components, and there's a faint component in the middle, which originally was thought to be the lensing galaxy, because this is the sort of usual configuration that you have in these cases. So what we did was we went with this, and we put a slit along these three components so we could get simultaneous, spatially resolved spectra of those three components. So what we found, I've just given a small example of the data here. I feel really sort of impoverished that I only have one line of sight with all these huge galaxy surveys. But you've got here the three lines of sight, so you can very clearly see that this is the faint middle component C. And so clearly this is the third lens image. It's not the lensing galaxy. So the lensing galaxy at the moment remains undetected. So I'm comparing this is sort of moderate resolution, 70 kilometers a second, with a spectrum that we took several years ago with high res on Keck that was spatially unresolved. So we just had the three blended images of all of those components, but with much higher spectral resolution. And so I've just shown an example here of the quality of those data, and also to demonstrate that how these systems break up into individual components. So this is a carbon-4 doublet. So you can see that in any given system, you have many different components, okay? And then we also have some singly ionized species like magnesium to some low ionization systems. So what the idea of this program is to look at the differences between these lines of sight and to see what you can infer about the sizes and the kinematics of these intervening systems. So the first sort of almost no-brainer thing to do is to compare between the lines of sight the equivalent widths of all of the intervening systems. Now, you could see from those FIS spectra, it's a very, very rich sight line. We have about 30 intervening absorption systems. So in just one line of sight, we've already got quite a nice galaxy sample. So all I'm plotting here is a comparison of two of those lines of sight, the two brightest components in A and B. And these points are open for the high ionization systems, which are typically at higher redshift just because of the rest wavelength of that transition. And also the low ionization systems, so typically magnesium 2, but also sometimes iron 2 and aluminium 2. And these are the filled points. So you can see very, very easily compared to the one-to-one relation, the high ionization systems, the carbon 4 and the silicon 4 systems, tend to trace each other very well between the lines of sight. Okay, we don't see large differences in those high ionization gas clouds. This is in very strong contrast to the low ionization systems. Okay, so here you can see in several cases, we will detect a low ionization cloud in one line of sight and it's totally absent in the other lines of sight. Okay, so that's the first thing to take away from this. Now, it's a bit of a cheat because the scales that we're probing are different, okay, because the redshifts of the high ionization lines is around 3, and for the low ionization lines, it's more like 1.5, okay? But bearing that in mind, we do see very strong differences between the low and the high ionization lines just on those scales.
Isn't it odd that it's not symmetric?
Yeah, we did wonder about that. And you see the same when you look in A and C or B and C in these combinations. We can't find any reason why this would be the case. It's not a signal-to-noise issue. And I think at the end of the day, the other thing is that three of these points, they are separate. They're galaxies that are separated by several hundred kilometers a second, but they are clustered. So it could be a group, something like that. Yeah.
So just telling that magnesium is smaller than carbon.
Right. Okay, so now we can think about trying to place real limits on, well, I said the size here, but more accurately, this should be the sort of the coherence scale, okay, of these gas clouds. So we can do this for the magnesium 2 systems because in some cases we only see them in one or two of the lines of sight. Okay, so with the carbon 4 we always see them in all three lines of sight. So we can only place a lower limit on those sizes. But that's a very interesting limit because other people who have done this same game before have probed much larger scales. This is a very fine scale. Okay, the largest separation between the A and C image is about 0.4 arc seconds. It's a very fine scale. With the magnesium 2, however, these are much rarer systems. So you don't find these so often in quasar lines of sight. Carbon 4 is much more common. So this is really the first time that anyone has done a statistical study of how large these systems are. So what we do is we assume a geometry for these gas clouds. So we assume a spherical halo, and then we play this maximum likelihood game where you say, okay, if I take two lines of sight and put them at random through the spherical halo, how often will I expect to see coincidences and anti-coincidences? So this is now a normalized likelihood for that model. Now, unfortunately, you can't really see the thick and the thin lines very clearly, but first of all, what we did was if you do that game with all of your magnesium 2 systems, this is the line that you get. Okay, this is just the sum, which is the cumulative likelihood in the dashed. Okay, so if you include all of them, this is what you get. So most likely radius of around 3 kiloparsecs. Now, this was kind of worrying when we first did this because it's pretty well accepted that these magnesium 2 halos are very, very large. So if you, there have been large surveys, most prominently by Chuck Seidel, who has actually been imaging these galaxies and calculating directly what their impact parameters are. And they find that these things are 50 kiloparsecs, right? And it's an order of magnitude smaller. So this is a little bit worrying. So what we did was we went back and we did a cut by equivalent width because the stereotypical magnesium 2 systems are very strong absorption, very strong absorbers. Because our spectra are so sensitive, most of the absorption lines that we've picked out are actually very weak. We've only got a couple of these very strong lines. So if you get rid of those, and the very few strong systems actually do always appear in all the lines of sight. If you just do this game with the weak systems, okay, this line here, so it's even smaller now, it goes down to 2 kiloparsecs. So maybe we're just looking at either two different populations, or just the weaker systems are further out in the galaxy, the covering factor is lower, and so you're inferring much smaller coherence scales. Okay, so now finally we'll look at how the variation of these coherent scales correlates with line of sight separation. I've now combined our data with some other data in the literature, most notably work that's been done by Michael Rauch. And so first of all, the high ionization systems. So these show a very nice correlation with line of sight separation. I hope you can read this as 0.1, 1, 10, and 100 kiloparsecs. So this does show that as you go further out, as the line of sight separation increases, the fractional variation does increase all the way out. So we can measure out to around 100 kiloparsecs. So maybe this is the signature of either very extended ionized halos, where metals are being mixed well out into the far halos of these galaxies, or we're already hitting the real intergalactic medium, wind enrichment very far out. Kurt Allerberger and his group have also been finding correlations in the Lyman alpha forest and metalline systems out to these scales. You can compare this to what we find with the low ionization systems. Now here there's no correlation at all, and the scatter in each bin is very large. Now this is because if you look, you can often trace the magnesium 2 systems between sight lines. Okay, so you'll see the same sort of galaxy, if you will, but it's almost impossible to ever trace a given component between the sight lines. So the components that are sitting in this sort of larger cloud are very, very clumpy and small. And so you can't trace these over, but the finest scale that has been traced is around 20 parsecs. So even over that relatively fine scale, you just can't trace that clumpy cold gas. So how can we draw all this together? So at small scales, the carbon 4 gas is virtually featureless. So it looks identical, even at high spectral resolution, between lines of sight. However, on these same scales, the low ionization gas is already very, very clumpy. Now this is very similar to what we see in galactic sight lines. There have been quite a number of studies tracing AU out to kiloparsec scales in the galactic interstellar medium, and they find qualitatively very similar things. So we also find that although the low ionization gas components are associated with small entities, the fact that we can't trace them between sight lines, the more complex systems, okay, so the whole absorption line is probably embedded in a larger halo, and we can try to measure these halos by this maximum likelihood technique, and we find for the weaker magnesium 2 systems that the typical coherence scale is on the order of 2 kiloparsecs. So this is in contrast with the several tens of kiloparsecs that you find when you look at strong absorption systems that are associated with the very bright galaxies. So you can either say these may be really different types of galaxies that you're probing, i.e. that the weaker systems are associated with possibly dwarf galaxies, or you might just have a lower covering factor, okay, as you get further out into the halo. And finally, we find that high ionization gas is coherent over relatively large scales, at least out to 100 kiloparsecs. So this could be already probing the intergalactic medium, but I think there's really mounting evidence that this is wind-enriched halos and large ionized gas halos in these galaxies. Okay, that's it.
You've made a comparison to other people who've done similar multiple line of sight study. I think you should also look at the very extensive database of downline analysis and study. These are single lines of sight,
mm-hmm.
but where one has typically exquisite spectra. And in particular, there's the Prochaska and Wolf data set.
Sure.
And I wanted to call your attention to the semi-analytic analysis of that by Irene Mahler, Rachel Somerville, Jason Prochaska, and me, where we definitely favor this picture of wind-enriched halo. The point being that there's very strong correlation between the magnesium, so the low ion line, and the damp line and alpha. And some over, some cross-correlation, which you're not seeing, apparently, with stronger features than the carbon-4.
Mm.
But basically, the carbon-4 velocity space fills the whole halo.
Right.
And
right.
The low ion lines are quite distinct.
Very clumpy.
They are presumably small clouds moving
yeah.
around in the halo.
Yeah.
That's the picture.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think what you're saying is very consistent.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So I'd also point out, though, that these low ionization lines, these magnesium fusion systems, would not, so we don't cover the H1 here. These would not be, you know, bona fide DLAs, right?
Right.
So they're not strong enough. But that's probably just a line of sight effect. You know, if you were at a smaller impact parameter, then they probably would be. But yeah.
Yeah,
it's the same thing, yeah.
So I'd be really, really interested to talk to you because I think there may be something similar that you can say in Leinberg galaxy outflows about the clumpiness of the neutral gas versus the more ionization. But I'm sorry if you said this, but I was just wondering, why do you think that the low ionization clouds are clumpier than the high ionization clouds?
Just because you can trace. Okay, so there are two ways of sort of characterizing this. You've got the actual system, right? And the system is made up of many components. Now,
why would they be?
Ah, so not why do we see them?
Yeah,
to be, no, okay.
I mean, why do you think they would be clumpier? I mean, are they not
the
same
this
water?
Is just. I'm going.
You need to have a lot of neutral hydrogen around them to set up the
shield yeah.
so that they stay low ionization. You're only going to find the magnesium 2 in regions that are shielded. So, inevitably, they're going to be.
Yeah, which is why it's easy to see the carbon 4 in the IgM, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you don't see the low ionization lines there.
So what is H1 filaments
for
the first time? They don't know.
Well, we've got with the, so we have the spatially unresolved high-res spectra. So these are typically going to be around, well, so the magnesium 2 is going to be around 10 to the 16.
No.
Not to self-shield.
They're 4 to the 19. Or 4 to the more.
But,
well, then it's not beginning in the right line.
Well, he's the only one, but
the thing is, you have to imagine that the spherical picture, they're just picking up the line of sight. It's a longer discussion, but I think you can...
This is a two-dimensional problem rather than a three-dimensional problem, that's fine.
I just wanted to comment also that in the same paper that Joel mentioned, we found that in order to get the broad velocity profile that observes in the dance and the alpha system, that you have to align the set, you have to through six multiple subclumps, which is what the central quantum is. And by simulation, we predicted that it has lower quantum because of the final limit system, but you should see predominantly find the set that passed through only a single clump. And I wonder if that's what's happening with your stronger and weaker magnesium systems. That's a really strong one. Maybe you're catching to some messy.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, you certainly see the stronger systems definitely have more components and are definitely messier. And these weaker systems, you can usually only split them into one or two components. But you know, this could also be a signal-to-noise thing, right? That you can imagine if you have a weak system and moderate signal-to-noise, then only one component may stick out above the noise. And if you have infinitely good signal-to-noise, you may pick up many more components. But certainly, qualitatively, that is what we're seeing. And I think that also is what you expect just from this covering factor argument, right?
Yeah.
So, the result that the weaker ones might be less, the weaker magnesium might be less, might be smaller than the stronger, is sort of counterintuitive to me in the sense that I would have thought that any cloud of gas would have a small dense portion of the center and then a larger undense portion.
Well, I guess the picture, can I draw on a board? The sort of picture that I have is you have a galaxy, right, and you have some clumps of enriched gas, okay, and these clumps are more densely packed, you have a higher covering factor in the center, and at the outside, you've only got them like this, right, so if you have a sight line that goes on the outer part, you'll have fewer components, okay, and therefore a weaker system, whereas if you go to the center, you'll have many components, and each of those components is contributing a column density, and so your overall equivalent width is larger.
It might also depend then on how
larger velocity range you use to decide if it's coincidence or not. I mean, it could be the velocity spread is quite large on the outskirts of the
area. Yeah, yeah.
So what did you use here?
Well, this is very simple matching. So you can see, okay, so positively you can already see that these things mostly match extremely well, okay? And when they don't match, so for example, this guy here is very clearly absent. Right, so you don't really have to ever put a limit on that.
Maybe better move on.